Hello, welcome to the first Vulval Pain Society podcast. I'm Sally Turner and with me is Dr. David Nunns, a gynaecologist and vulval pain specialist based in Nottingham, who founded the Vulval Pain Society in 1996. There's plenty of information on the VPS website about the various vulval conditions and symptoms and treatments. So in this first podcast, we thought we'd explore the wider perspective and address some of the questions that have arisen at support group meetings and via the vulval pain emailing groups. So, hi David.
Hello, welcome.
So perhaps we could begin by just talking about what prompted you to choose gynaecology and vulval pain as your specialist area of medicine. And I wonder what inspires you and what frustrates you about working in this area.
Well, I chose obstetrics and gynaecology really for the obstetric component of the job. And as the years went by, I've sort of settled in gynaecology, mainly gyne-oncology. But I had an opportunity many years ago in about 96, 95 to work in what was termed a vulval clinic up in Manchester. And I did some research for 2 years there and really maintained the interest after I completed the research, because it did strike me that this was really an area of women's health that needed to be developed, because at that time there was very little in terms of information for women and partners, and hence the setting up of the group in 1996. What inspires me? Well, I think that there are many doctors who I work with, colleagues, that do extremely well in managing women with vulval problems. Obviously, they're not as sort of high profile as perhaps myself is attached to the VPS, but these are doctors who offer excellent services and really go the full length and more with some of the patients. I think the women as well, some of the stories I hear from women who come back to me with on follow-up visits or perhaps contact the VPS with their successes are very inspiring. Women who've really worked through quite a difficult time in terms of their vulvodynia, in terms of treatment and where they were at that time in their life when they were first diagnosed. To see them get better and to share that with other women, I think, is very inspiring and very positive. Frustrations, well, I suppose the frustrating problem with vulval care, specifically vulvodynia, is the current model of care that we have for women. We do have this very medicalized model of care that relies on clinicians to provide treatment for women with vulvodynia, and we need to change that. We need to move away from hospital outpatients with clinicians as the sole treatment. We really need to widen the horizon and develop as health professionals new ways of looking after women with vulval pain.
And do you have any advice from a doctor's perspective on how to have a successful appointment with a vulval pain specialist? Because often we focus on what we need from an appointment as patients, but I wonder what you need from us in terms of providing the best care.
Yes, I think that most women with a diagnosis of vulvodynia are going to be initially seeing their GP as the first port of call, and may or may not be referred on to a hospital for a specialist appointment. That might be a gynaecologist, might be a dermatologist, GU physician, or even a vulval clinic. All these hospital settings provide care for women with vulval pain, and as such there's no real vulval pain specialist service that's set up in the country, but the vulval clinics and the hospital specialists should be able to provide basic care. I think from my perspective, it's always helpful when people come along to have the questions written down, to have their information of past treatments, things that have worked, that haven't worked, scribbled down on paper, just so that it just saves time and it avoids forgetting things, and also importantly avoids trying treatments that have already been explored previously. I'm quite conscious that patients have not the greatest experience in hospitals. It takes an hour to park and it can be very frustrating and anxious waiting in the waiting room, and then you sort of come to the waiting into the consultation, you sort of forget what the doctor said to you. So I think bringing a friend's a good idea, Asking for a GP letter is also very helpful, so that you understand what's been said to the GP in terms of prescriptions and dosages and where to get the prescriptions from. Because I think there is sometimes quite a big communication gap between what patients understand and what and the hospital specialist and what the GP understands from the hospital specialist. So certainly asking for a GP letter is a good idea.
So David, any advice on getting the best from our GPs, sort of initial referrals for vulval pain and ongoing treatment?
That's a good question. And I think it's important to remember that there are many GPs looking after women with vulvodynia in the community and do so extremely well. Many women have been through the hospital system and have been discharged back to the GP for ongoing care, and there are many GPs and patients working together on different treatments, exploring different treatments. And I think for many women with vulvodynia, that's probably going to be the sort of the best model of care in the future. I think it's important to mention that not all vulval pain is vulvodynia, and you really need to get a proper diagnosis initially, and a referral is not always necessary, because many GPs can take a good history, assess the woman and treat many causes of vulval pain without a referral. I guess the problem is when initial treatments don't work, or the GP is uncertain of what's going on, uncertain of the diagnosis, that a referral may be suggested. And that's when you would be referred on to the hospital for gynaecology, GU medicine, dermatology, or even the local vulval clinic. There are a lot of GPs who are unaware of vulvodynia, and I know this is a problem, and this is a problem of education, training, and general awareness of vulval problems. My practice is usually to inform the GP, give the GP information on vulvodynia, and the vast majority of GPs are quite happy to keep this information and store it within the practice. Practice nurses are also very important, and many women will open up to a practice nurse, and so they may also be a good resource within a GP surgeon, somebody to approach.
So any advice on NHS, sort of the rules and referrals? What are the rules and referrals in terms of being referred to a specialist out of your local authority area, for instance?
Well, there are two systems of care, the National Health Service, the public service, and the private sector. Most women with vulval pain are going to be seeing their GP initially and may be referred to the local hospital. Now, with the choose and book system that is up and running in this country, a GP in his or her surgery will be able to look down a list of local providers in the GP surgery area, and that might be a number of hospitals and a number of services within the hospital. So in that choose and book system, the GP can choose where to refer the patient. Now, this might be a vulval clinic within the local hospital, it might be a vulval clinic in another hospital, it might be dermatology, gynaecology, or even genitourinary medicine, but it does depend on what services are available in the area. In the private sector, patients can literally take a GP letter to the private hospital and see any number of consultants. Vulval clinics really haven't established themselves in the private sector, but the consultants practicing in the NHS in the vulval clinics frequently, but not always, practice in private practice. This is another option for patients. Obviously, cost is an issue. And there may be more scope for more continuity of care in the private sector with consultants, rather than back in the NHS, where follow-up visits might involve different doctors.
So, David, can you explain briefly how women's healthcare in the NHS is funded and how the clinic system works? And I'm wondering, how are success rates actually measured, or are there any sort of things in place to measure that?
Well, we've got a publicly funded health service, and most of the budget for this lies with primary care trusts. These are bodies of GPs who really commission the services from the local hospitals. In women's health, that's mainly obstetrics and gynaecology. The setting up of vulval clinics and services surrounding vulval problems aren't necessarily something that primary care trusts commission, i.e. they're not services that GPs usually ask for in the local hospital. But these have been set up historically in hospitals because of the local need within the community and the will of individual doctors to set something up for the needs of the patient. It's interesting to ask about the success rates of treatment, because we do patient surveys and we are interested in the sort of patient experience, but again, in vulvar disease, there's very little to know about what the quality is of the care that we give and sort of outcomes of the care. We really need to focus on this in the future, and this is quite easily done with patient surveys and that, but there's a huge need for good quality research and sort of quality of life issues to be carried out in vulval disease. So at the moment, it's a bit of a black hole, I'm afraid.
So at that moment, if you don't have someone returning to the clinic, it's almost you have no idea whether they've actually got better or whether they've just dropped out of the system or gone somewhere else.
We've no data, and this has been the problem in putting our argument forwards for funding and team working and resource into looking after women with vulval problems. We have no data on how common vulval diseases and vulvodynia is in society, in our GP surgeries, in our hospitals. We've no data as to what we're offering the women. One hospital might offer one service, another might offer a completely different service for the women. In some hospitals, it's extremely well set up with good networks of doctors and physios and sex therapists. In other hospitals, it's extremely patchy with no interest. So this needs to really to be collected, but that takes time and resource.
And David, I remember hearing a figure of sort of 15% of women suffer from vulval pain in the UK. I can't remember where that came from. I wonder if you could shed some light on that and whether we do actually know how many women have the condition.
The 15% comes from a study in the States, a phone consultation questionnaire type study where they found in the southern part of North America that 15% of women had pain for more than 3 months in their lifetime. And although it's not totally robust in the reporting, i.e. we can't be absolutely certain that these women definitely had vulvodynia, it gives us a rough idea that the problem's common. We don't have any data in this country as to how often women develop vulvodynia, how many women respond to treatment, and how women it just simply gets better. It needs proper research. We know that in vulval clinics, and certainly in some gynecology clinics and dermatology clinics that have an interest in vulval problems, that it is common because this is one of the biggest sources of referral. But in the general population as a whole, we've no idea.
So is there any news on sort of latest research into causes and treatments and so on? I know that research is like a huge area, which might come back to in another podcast, but if there's anything particular that's come up recently you could talk about, that would be great.
Well, there's lots of research going on into vulval diseases in general, both in this country and internationally. The Americans really are very far forward in terms of research into vulval disease, and particularly vulval pain. Not a huge amount of research into vulvodynia in this country, but a huge amount of work into chronic pain in our understandings of chronic pain, not specifically vulvodynia. I think that we're feeling now that there is, in vulvodynia, in particularly those women with the touch-sensitive pain or the sort of provoked localized vestibulodynia groups, that would be our understanding of those women we used to call vestibulitis, that there seems to be some initial cause for the pain, either an attack of thrush or an attack of a urinary tract infection. And then as these symptoms subside, that there is some change in the nerve endings, in the nervous system, in the vulval area. Things don't quite go back to normal. And this develops into what becomes a chronic pain problem. And this is similar to other chronic pain problems in the body. And this would explain why drugs such as the amitriptyline drugs and gabapentin, Lyrica, do work to try and reverse the changes that happen in the peripheral nerves, in the skin.
So could you perhaps explain a little bit more about the nervous system, why the nerve cells continue to fire off pain messages even after the initial triggers removed?
Yes, pain's a very important symptom. We need to have a perception of pain to protect ourselves, and there's two types of pain: acute pain, which we need as a sensation to prevent injury to ourselves. Putting your hand on a hot plate will cause you to recoil your hand and protect yourself from tissue damage, and acute pain subsides fairly quickly, and it's very different to what can develop over the long term with chronic pain. And chronic pain understanding is increasing dramatically in recent years, and we now have an understanding that it's not simply a skin problem, but it's more of a general problem involving the central nervous system, i.e. the brain, the spinal cord, and all the nerve endings that connect the brain to the skin. And when a chronic problem develops, when I say chronic more than 6 months, as in, for example, vulvodynia, there are subtle changes in the programming of the nerves within the skin. And we have pain receptors or pain nerve fibers in the skin, but we also have other nerve endings in the skin, such as touch, and pressure, and heat and cold receptors. And it's subtle changes in these nerve fibers that probably contribute to the problem of touch pain and excess sensitivity in vulvodynia. And it's this reprogramming of the nerves that leads to a chronic problem. Now, this isn't just a skin problem, as I mentioned, it's actually a problem within the whole system. And so there is a pain centre in the brain that is also affected in chronic pain. I suppose an example might be somebody who experiences phantom limb pain after an amputation. That pain is felt where the leg was amputated, but it's still remembered in the brain. There's memory of the pain in the brain, just showing how the brain and the peripheral nerves are intimately connected. And this is important because this means that simply, for example, in vulvodynia, putting creams on the skin simply don't work in isolation. And it does it help explain why drugs such as the tricyclic drugs and gabapentin, Lyrica, do work, because it tackles the whole approach to pain. It tackles the central nervous system part of the pain experience. And it also explains why holistic treatments such as acupuncture and simple things like relaxation, exercise, distraction type treatments work very well for all types of chronic pain, and vulval pains included in that.
So once these nerve pathways or these pain pathways are set up in the body, presumably there's a way of, what we're trying to do is reprogram them with the drugs and desensitizing type programs. And one would hope eventually that you could reprogram then the pathway to the brain and back to pleasure rather than pain.
Yes, it's not all about drugs. It's not all about taking amitriptyline and gabapentin, although they form one part of the package of treatment. I think ideally you're trying to break the chronic pain cycle. You're trying to grind a halt to this excess activity within the central nervous system from the site of pain to the brain. And that there's so many different ways of doing that, and books have been written on chronic pain management, which are certainly worthy of exploring. I think there's a feeling, certainly amongst health professionals who look after women with vulval pain, and particularly sex-related pain, that desensitizing the vulval area is very important. When I say desensitization, it's really a physical process of trying to normalise the sensation on the vulva, i.e. reduce the pain sensation on the vulva through a number of physical treatments, and that might be simple massage, use of vaginal trainers, seeing a physiotherapist for exercises, or even relaxation treatments associated with just relaxing the pelvic floor muscles. So it's quite a wide term, but it generally is, I think, engages the woman with her treatment, helps her become less phobic about touch, and obviously that's very important when you've got sex-related pain, as is often the case in vestibular dynia.
So, David, would you say that vulvodynia is a modern phenomenon in sort of more affluent societies, or is there evidence to suggest that women have actually suffered from this for centuries, and that it's actually cross-cultural and happens, you know, in all sorts of different situations and cultures around the world?
Well, I think there's good evidence to show that this is a historic condition. There's some very clear descriptions of women with vulvodynia from the turn of the century. And if you look at some of the very old textbooks that were written by very famous gynecologists, they describe women in these early, very early descriptions of pain and touch sensitivity. Of course, they weren't diagnosed with vulvodynia then, but it's clear, looking back, that they actually had vulvodynia. I think that it's certainly not a condition of the Western world. I do some overseas work in Nepal and rural communities there once a year, and we do gynecology camps in small villages, and we see women with vulvodynia. We see women complaining of pain, of burning soreness, there's no skin condition to see, and there's no infection, and they have vulvodynia, just as we would see it in this country. And the treatments are obviously limited in that setting, but we would treat the women there as we would treat them here, usually with drug treatment. So it's not a condition of the Western world. I think we're seeing more women coming forward with vulvodynia, probably because we're better at diagnosing it rather than labelling as recurrent thrush, which was always the case. We're correctly classifying patients according to what they've got. And this has resulted in a larger number of referrals to the hospital. And vulva clinics are quite well aware of this. I don't think we're dealing with a new disease, as it were, i.e. suddenly more women are developing it. Although I don't truly know whether for younger people we're going to see more and more vestibular dynia type problems, i.e. sex-related problems, in the future. And that may be relevant to our perceptions of sex in society for young people. The internet, magazines from their peers. Expectations are quite high from many of us now, more so for young people. And there is pressure on young people to meet certain standards, and if you don't quite meet up to the mark,
yeah,
you're not, you know, you're really not part of the norm. Mm. And certainly I think that may have a role to play in the future with regards to sexual pain. That's certainly the feeling from my colleagues who work in sex therapy, where an increase in number of referrals are young men and women who have psychosexual problems because of not meeting their expectations of what they have unreal expectations of what sex should be.
Yeah, I suppose these days, obviously, young people have more access to the internet and more information through magazines and things about their expectations are higher around sex. But they also have more access to where to find help, whereas women of older generation might not have that access. But it's interesting what you're saying about it's kind of cross-cultural and it happens in developing countries and it's in all over the place, which would lead me to believe that perhaps, that, do you think there is some sort of genetic predisposition to it then? It's not just about, you know, sort of thrush treatments that we use in this country triggering it. I mean, there's lots of different triggers, but that it's perhaps something that's, do you think has a sort of genetic element to it? Or
Much of the early data suggested that this was a condition of Caucasian, fair-haired women. There were reports of it being commoner in siblings, but that data was from private practices in North America, where inherently you'd get a large proportion of Caucasian fair-haired women. I think the evidence suggests now, practice suggests, that that's not quite the case. Certainly in my own practice, I see a cross-section of women from sort of middle-class, lower-class communities in Nottingham, and certainly different races coming forward. So the genetics hasn't quite been cleared up, although I think there is some evidence to suggest that genetics might be involved, and that might be relevant to chronic pain in general. You know, why should somebody who has a bad attack of thrush or cystitis go on to develop a residual pain syndrome, which becomes a chronic pain syndrome, and other people get better? I don't think we've quite got the answer to that, but genetics may be important.
So is there a male equivalent to vulvodynia, and do men also get lichen sclerosis?
The answer to that is yes, and when we talk about vulvodynia, we're talking about one of the members of the Dynia family. Dynia, D-Y-N-I-A, literally means burning. And we have vulvodynia, as you know, but we also have scrotal dynia in the men. We have stomatodynia, which is of the tongue, so we have patients with burning tongues. We have coccygeodynia, which is burning in the coccyx area. Of course, in my own specialty, along with my colleagues, we're going to see vulvodynia predominantly, but we know that women with stomatodynia go to the oral surgeons, with scrotal dynia go to urologists, and they're exactly the same. They're chronic pain syndromes, and the management is the same. We actually get men right into the VPS asking for our handbook because they've done the research. They know that the strategies of treatment for scrotal pain is the same as for vulval pain, and so they want the handbook to get some ideas of treatment. So the men are a really a lost group at the moment. There's no real support for them, but we know they exist.
I was going to say, do you think there are as many men, you know, the numbers are the sort of equivalent to the number of women that are coming forward with vulvodynia, or is it quite a sort of smaller subgroup of men you think that would suffer in that way?
I really don't know. Again, very little in terms of research on the men. Mm. If you look in vulvodynia, what's published now and what was published 10 years ago, we've come on leaps and bounds. But if you look now, what's published on men, it's like it was 20 years ago. So it's a real unknown. You mentioned lichen sclerosis, which is different to vulvodynia. It's a skin condition. This is a condition of men and women, mainly women, but the men do get the same disease on the foreskin, and it causes similar problems to women. Main problems, splitting of the skin and itching. But yes, the men do get the same issues that the women do. I think the main issue is that it's genital skin, which is inherently different to skin on other parts of the body, so there is an overlap in the conditions.
Somebody actually emailed in a question to the London Vulva Pain Support Group, the emailing group, which was, what are the key things I can relay to my 12-year-old daughter with regard to her sexual health? And I don't want her to have the same traumatic journey that I had growing up with vulval pain. So perhaps you could answer that.
Yes, I suppose it's all about education for young people. There's no evidence that children of women with vulval pain, vulvodynia, go on to develop it. So I wouldn't feel that she was at risk of developing a vulval pain syndrome because sort of mum had it. I mean, I think, as with any young person, just education on symptoms, sort of encouraging any person to report irregular symptoms, for example, bleeding after intercourse, irregular periods, going for smears, good contraception, and the HPV vaccine are all sort of things that you want young people to engage in. So it's down to education and reporting things should they arise, but reassurance really that she shouldn't be at risk if mum's got it.
Okay, great. And finally, we'll just tackle a few questions around thrush. I know this is a huge area again, but perhaps to talk about sort of what do we know for sure about the connection with thrush, and what do we know? Do we know for sure that, you know, topical thrush treatments are a trigger, which they seem to be in quite a number of women? And should we be using oral capsules, you know, all the time rather than constantly applying creams. And perhaps you could just say a little bit about thrush on swabs. And sometimes thrush doesn't show up on a swab, but it still seems that we have symptoms at a low level.
Yeah, so some of my research a few years ago looked at the onset of symptoms in women with what we used to call vestibulitis, which we've now called vestibulodynia. The question is, does thrush trigger off symptoms? Or was it a misdiagnosis in the beginning? And my research found roughly a third of women who developed vestibulitis or vestibulodynia actually could pinpoint a bad attack of thrush as the onset of all symptoms, i.e. they were fine the day before, they developed the thrush, and then problems happened since then. And I guess we just don't know, was it the thrush or was it the topical cream that was used? Mm-hmm. Certainly there's some anxieties about using creams on the vulva in women who've got vulvodynia, because pain is there already and you're going to put something on that may cause irritancy. So does thrush trigger off the problem? Possibly. Is thrush a reason for ongoing symptoms? Unlikely in vulvodynia, because vulvodynia is what we would call a nerve syndrome, of a neuropathic problem, a nerve ending type problem. And thrush, when present, usually causes irritation, itching, and a discharge. Now, of course, you can get the two together, because thrush is very common in adult women. And because you've got vulvodynia or any vulval problem, lichen sclerosis, lichen planus, you're still not immune to getting thrush. So it's just being aware, really, of possibly a change in symptoms. So, for example, you might have vulvodynia, but you might notice a flare-up of symptoms, and that would be a time maybe to consider thrush, maybe itching, soreness, more pain, a discharge. So what do you do? Well, this is difficult for most women because healthcare isn't set up right to make that easy for you. What I tend to do in my practice is, if there's a question of thrush, is it relevant or not, which it may be, I tend to give the woman a series of swabs to take. I'm not alone on that. I think many doctors realise that the swabs are very useful. Thrush being the yeast, usually grows on a swab. And the woman can take the swab at home, put the swab in the vagina, put it in its packet and drop it off at the surgery or at the hospital. And if you've got, say, half a dozen swabs taken over several months and they're all positive, then it may be relevant to treat with an antifungal, not a one-off, but a maintenance dose. For example, Diflucan, which is quite safe to take, one tablet a fortnight for 3 months, for example, or even longer. But if all the swabs are negative, then you might question whether that was necessary. And that's a very simple exercise. And it just, I think, reassures a lot of people that we're not missing anything, because that's the worry, isn't it, that you're missing something.
Okay, so if we come to a close now, I wonder if you'd just like to let us know of any sort of latest news or developments in the area of vulval pain.
Well, I think there's a lot to be positive about for the future. We have an organisation, a national group called the British Society for the Study of Vulval Diseases. This is a group of health professionals who are very multidisciplinary and interested in vulval problems. And they're really taking things forward. Some guidelines have been produced and they'll be available soon. This is a sort of a guide for any health professional looking after women to start basic treatments. And we hope that those will be sort of published and read far and wide. There's a lot of work going on in chronic pain care in terms of not just research, but in terms of funding and raising awareness. So that's quite exciting. So really watch this space. And we at the VPS realise the importance of research, and we're planning to do a research page for the website, which will encompass the latest research and how realistically that can translate from a medical journal into a woman logging onto the website and reading it, and that should be online very soon.
Okay, great. Well, thank you very much, David. This is obviously just the first podcast that we're going to do with a lot of general questions, so we will be coming back to specific areas and hopefully doing a podcast with some partners of women with vulval pain and talking to some other specialists. So we look forward to doing that in the future.